Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we even like the stand.
I cut the monitor out of my TV and just put a book there.
Every night you just turn the page.
I just turn the page. Sometimes I try to do it with remote control and I get angry because it doesn't work.
I'd do that except the cat would just like knock it down.
Yeah, that's true. So I'm Ben.
I'm Gabs.
And that's us.
We are finally back.
Yeah, that's true. This is actually the first time we're recording in like 3 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll open with the spoiler policy.
Yeah, the spoiler policy is that we spoil everything.
Yep, every single thing. Give no shits if you care about the spoiler. So if you do care about the spoiler, this would be a good time to stop listening until you've read the book.
Yeah.
And if you haven't done that with this book, I recommend you budget about 3 years of your life to do it.
Because it's so long.
It is so long.
And it, like, I guess the last 150 pages don't really have any spoiler bombs, but, you know, a lot of people die.
Yeah, pretty much everybody dies.
Yeah, that's actually not really an exaggeration.
Virtually everyone is dead. So the book, by the way, is The Stand by Stephen King. Many of you are familiar with Stephen King from, like, 1,000 books.
Yeah, Stephen King is so well known, and all of his books get made into movies, although not always good ones.
That's true.
Actually, often bad ones.
He writes the screenplay on a lot of the good ones, actually.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Carrie, The Shining, It.
Misery.
Misery, which is an awesome movie.
That's pretty awesome.
I'd recommend that. The Mist.
The Mist. I really enjoyed that one. The movie actually had a darker end than the book in that one.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. I thought the end of that movie was hardcore.
Yeah, the end of the book is indeterminate, and the movie people fucking blow their brains out.
And in The Stand, The Stand actually has a movie adaptation as well.
Yes, though I haven't had the pleasure of seeing it yet.
Yeah, it's like a 4-part TV miniseries.
I may get around to it.
Apparently they cut out some of the graphic things for television content.
Pshaw!
I know, right? What dark things happen in this book? I don't know, I think once you've committed to killing off 99% of the population, like, what is more graphic than that?
I don't know. I guess you could not show as much of the blood and guts and just get right into the good versus evil overarching storyline. So, that's more or less why we're doing the book. Not for corpses, but because everybody knows Stephen King.
Yeah, and tons of people love The Stand.
Yeah, it's one of his more popular books. He says it is. Anecdotally, that's definitely true. I know that we've both run into people who've said that they don't particularly love Stephen King, but they really enjoyed The Stand.
Yeah, when I was in Arizona traveling last weekend, I ran into two people who said they didn't like Stephen King, but loved The Stand.
And you'd have to love The Stand, at least a little bit.
Because it's so long!
It's 1,100 pages of 2-point font. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's absurdly long.
Just a little extra information on it, I guess. The edition we read, the one that most people presumably are familiar with, was released in 1990, and was actually, there was another edition that was, I think, printed in 1978, and that version had 120,000 words cut out of it.
Yeah.
Compared to the newer edition. That, for those of you who don't know exactly how that translates, that's roughly 400 pages of text. That is longer than the majority of commercial novels.
Yeah, 120,000 words is, like, hitting epic territory.
Yeah, most novels are in the 60 to 100,000 word range. 100,000 is actually fairly long for a commercial novel.
Yeah.
So he had a long novel cut out of the book, and he added it back in for the 1990 release because he's Stephen King.
He's Stephen fucking King.
Yeah, who's going to tell him no?
That boggles my mind, though, because that means that the book was still originally, like, 700 pages long. So insane.
Which which means the whole work has to be something like 350 to 400,000 words, probably.
Yeah, it's so, it's ridiculous.
It's so much writing.
Also, the other thing that happened was from the 1978 release to the 1990 release, I read that he updated the flu so that it happened in 1990 instead of 1980. So there are a couple of cultural things that got pushed up 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. I personally don't really want to read it, but I do think it'd be funny if he released it again in like 2019 and added another 400 pages to it.
I just don't think it would work as well that way. All the new technology. I guess you could add a bunch of like Twitter feeds, like people freaking out.
That's right.
Texting each other about it.
My whole family died. Hashtag this sucks.
I bet some twat on Twitter would actually do that.
Probably.
Here goes. Twitter. We have an account though, but you know. So I guess if you haven't been able to tell already, the genre of the book is
apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Not post-apocalyptic. This book is fully apocalyptic.
Yes, the apocalypse, at least during the first half of the book, is happening to the characters.
Yes. Something, I believe this virus's infection and fatality rate is 99.4%. So, goodbye almost everyone.
Yeah, that means, like, oh, what did we estimate for the population of Kansas City?
Kansas City, let's see. Well, what you'd have is 4 survivors for every 1,000 people. Yeah. So if there are 1 million people in the Kansas City area, then it's about 4,000 survivors.
Yeah.
For that entire metro area.
And probably all of your family and friends are going to die if you happen to be one of the people who survives it.
There were no instances in the book of family members or people who knew each other previously surviving.
Well, one.
I take that back. They were both in the same town.
But they didn't really know each other, though.
Right.
But yeah, other than that, like, you know, what, Mother Abigail has, like, a bunch of kids and, like, 17 grandkids and, like, 32.
Yeah.
Like, some ridiculous number of extended family. And she's the only one who survived.
Despite being, like, 108.
Yeah. Ridiculous. So our plot synopsis of the book.
The plot synopsis is everybody dies. Then everybody else dies.
Yeah.
Seriously, everybody in this book freaking dies.
Everybody dies. It's the initial, you know, millions upon millions of deaths. And then you have the deaths of all the characters that you know.
Yeah, because go figure, after the flu destroys the entire social structure and infrastructure of the country, basically, it's kind of hard to stay alive.
Yeah, a lot of people are dying for other reasons besides just the flu.
Yeah, like diseases you'd be fine with if, you know, there was a open hospital with a qualified doctor in it.
Yeah.
Or driving down the road and some a-hole with a rifle decides that he's going to kill you and take his stuff because there's no one to stop him.
Yep.
Or the,
you know, if you're like a 5-year-old and your entire family dies and you can't fend for yourself anymore.
It was the kid who broke his leg and starved to death. And
yeah.
There were some fairly horrible,
very cheerful
post-plague little 2-paragraph vignettes. So yeah, the story does take place in the good old U.S. of A.
It does. We actually don't really get anything about other countries besides the United States.
Yeah, we assume that they're all dead too, but
yeah, we know just enough to know that when the U.S. was dying off, the government decided that they wanted to send the super flu to everybody else.
Yeah, that was specifically mentioned.
Just to make sure.
Oh, shoot, we're all gonna die. Well, better make sure we drop this in Moscow and Beijing and
so rude.
You guys are dicks.
Ben and I were postulating that we think it's possible that maybe Australia and New Zealand stuck it out.
They would need to get news. Any island nation that got news of what was happening to the rest of the world quickly enough to shut down air travel might have a chance.
Right, because otherwise someone's going to get on an airplane with a cold and then...
Yeah, this flu is so virulent that if one case makes it anywhere before fully showing symptoms, then you're screwed.
Yeah, and actually, that's how the entire thing starts, is one case of the flu.
Yep, that's true. The book opens in a facility where the security measures have malfunctioned, basically. There's a door that was supposed to slam shut, and it didn't, and so dude scampers out, grabs his family, hits the road, and murders the entire United States.
Yeah.
And the entire world, really, when you get down
to it. Yeah. Basically, if that door had shut like it was supposed to and that guy hadn't gotten out, he would have died of the super flu.
Yeah.
And then...
The whole facility would have been wiped out.
Yep.
But the world would have been fine.
Or maybe if he had gotten out, but they'd managed to shut down the little town or fort they were living in before he slipped out, too.
Yeah, but once he was outside of the city limits...
They were...
The world was done for.
Yep. He crashes the hell in Texas, and then... They're fucked.
Yep. I guess I'm getting to some characters here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, the guy crashes in Arnett, Texas, and we meet our first main character, and Ben and I are going to make the argument that he is the protagonist of the novel.
If I had to choose one, he would be the guy. Stuart Redman. Goes by Stu most of the book.
Yep.
He's a laconic Texan, as they always are in stories.
Yes.
Well, either that or they're big, noisy oil tycoon types.
He's like a Lee Scoresby type.
Yeah, he's kind of. He's definitely the cowboy type.
Yeah.
Texan. And that pretty much describes his whole character, honestly.
Well, I remember actually at the beginning, his life was already full of tragedy before any of this crap even happened.
Yeah, lived in a depressed area.
Yeah.
Lost his job.
He was working on and off. His mother died. His brother left and was successful somewhere else.
Right.
His wife died at the age of, like, 27.
Yeah, from some sort of cancer.
And their baby died. So... His life kind of sucks.
Yeah, he wasn't having a great time. And, well, fortunately for him, it was about to get a lot worse.
Fortunately for him. Yeah, I actually liked Stu in the beginning, and I think the thing I liked about Stu wasn't necessarily him, like his character, but just what was happening to him. Because when this guy and his wife and daughter crash into the gas station in Texas and give everyone the flu... I mean, this is the first outbreak, and so the government goes there to try and shut it down. Too late, but they try, and they take all the people in Arnett and ship them off to a facility, to a CDC center, to try and, cure them or figure out who's immune or anything like that, and Stuart's the only one, and he's kind of stuck there in, like, a quarantine area where no one will give him any information.
Yeah, and as it goes along, even the people who are working in the facility are succumbing to the flu, so for some reason he's immune, no one knows why, but...
They've been testing his blood, and there doesn't seem to be anything.
But he always takes things pretty much in stride.
Yeah.
He is very direct in his dealings with other people.
Yep.
When he decides he's going to speak, he has something to say.
And he's, like, you know, good old boy, doesn't really do the wrong thing, doesn't really have an internal struggle considering, like, himself. When he brains the doctor in the facility,
He feels kind of bad about it.
Kind of freaks out about it.
I mean, he has some psychological moments that you'd expect a functioning human being to have, yeah. I think.
But what I was telling Ben, because he'd already read it once, I never had, was that... By the time I got a certain amount of the way through the book, I just went, Stu's kind of boring.
A lot of the characters in the book, actually, are pretty static.
Yeah, a lot of them start interesting, and I think it's because, again, the circumstances are so compelling, because everyone's dying, and it's, like, nuts.
Yeah.
But a lot of them turn really boring.
Yeah, I mean, the first 300 or 400 pages is pretty much nonstop mayhem.
Yeah.
And so that's really interesting and reads really fast.
Yep.
But then once you're free of the mayhem and it's down more to survival, you know, the traveling parts are okay, too.
Yeah,
it's really not until they settle down and try to start reforming society.
It gets kind of stagnant.
Yeah, and it's a lot of that is because the characters are kind of static.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think they're growing into leadership roles in some cases, but they were kind of the de facto leaders of their little bands of people they'd been traveling with anyway.
Yeah, it was almost one of those situations, like, here are the people you've been following, now they're in a little makeshift society with, like, 1,000 people, and because they're the ones you've been following, they're gonna be the leaders of this little society, basically.
Yeah, something like
that. Kind of felt like that.
I agree. And if there is a major weakness to the book, it probably is that the characters are almost all static.
Yeah. I was saying especially Stu, and then I really liked Franny at first, but once Stu and Franny got together, their relationship was so boring.
It was really uninteresting. It was pretty much, I like you, let's bang constantly.
That's, like, the entire basis of their relationship.
That's their whole relationship.
Yeah.
And Franny was so quirky and funny for the first chunk of the book.
Yeah.
And had so many, like, real human emotions. Yep. And her, I guess, like, it's almost like a little mini origin story for each of the characters as they're going through the plague.
Uh-huh.
And hers is one of the more interesting ones because she's pregnant out of wedlock. She's a college girl. She's dealing with it. Her mom is really conservative, uptight. And
her dad's really cool.
Yeah.
And about it.
She's just struggling with stuff, and then she's struggling with her kind of tool of a boyfriend who she is realizing is actually kind of a tool.
The poet looking out into the ocean. I was like, oh no.
And then dealing with all the death and destruction around her. And
you know, one of the things I really liked about Franny initially was, like, when you said she was quirky, it was like her dad, when they were talking to each other, both of them have a tendency to kind of laugh at inappropriate moments.
Yeah.
Because they'll, like, think of, like, something that's ridiculous in this serious situation. Now I want to laugh, but that person will get mad at me. Like, he says you can't fight off King Laugh or whatever it is. And
yeah, she's like, prone to the gigs.
Yeah. I liked that. And she, once her family was dying, she's pretty resourceful, like, working through it, and I felt for her because I really liked her dad.
Yeah.
Like, I made a connection with him before he died, so then I was able to feel more sympathy for her.
Well, even though her mom was being kind of bitchy to her, I'm sure there are a lot of people who read the book who really didn't like the mother character.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a thing in Stephen King novels, actually. Yeah. But this woman was not even remotely close to the kind of crazy that the typical Stephen King crazy mom character is. She was just, again, like, kind of a conservative, uptight woman, and she was freaking out, but Franny was obviously hurt by it, so it wasn't like she had no relationship with her mother at all.
Right, because if she was just used to mom screaming at her all the time, then
yeah, she just shrugged it off.
Yeah.
So, out of the same town, I guess.
Yeah.
Was
Angunquit? I have no idea to
that sounds
it.
Right. Angunquit?
Angunquit? I was like, what the?
Native American town in Maine.
Yeah, they're in Maine. Surprise.
Yeah, another shocker.
Oh, Stephen King. Take a shot for all you The Stand
that's right.
drinking game people out there.
Harold Lauder.
Yep.
Who is the, well, basically he's the fat, nerdy, slightly pretentious high school kid.
Yeah.
And he's the only other survivor from the town.
Yeah, which bums Franny out a little bit, because he's not really socially,
He is incredibly socially inept.
Yeah.
And I've known a few people like him in my day.
Yeah, you know.
I feel for him a little, actually.
I do, too. It's like, you know, if he kind of learned some shit and grew up a little bit, then he'd be an okay dude.
Yeah, and he kind of does.
Yeah, one of the things I actually liked about Harold's character before I, like, hated him a lot was, even though, like, he is a nerd, because Larry Underwood's party is following him across the United States, you actually learn how resourceful he is.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's definitely smart.
Painting signs for people, managing to find gas, like, you know, modes of transportation, going this way and this way, like, he really is
People who meet him always tend to have this reaction of, he sure knows a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And he's pretty likable during that whole
thing. Yeah, because he is growing a little. He is kind of coming into himself, and like the last couple of stories I've read with a fat, socially inept character in it, they never get any less fat or socially inept, and it pisses me off.
Yeah.
And he...
Game of Thrones cough cough.
Yeah, Sam... Sam... anyway, he actually not only becomes more adult, but he's, like, losing the weight because he's trekking across the country.
Yeah.
So he has no choice in the matter. You know, if you're marching 20 miles a day, you're not going to stay fat for very long.
Yeah.
Especially when food is probably not plentiful.
Yeah, it's not like they're all eating a lot or anything, so...
And he even lays off the candy bars on top of that.
Yeah. He makes a decision.
That's right.
I was like, fool. I would get fatter because I'd just be eating all of the candy bars.
All the candy is free. You have only like a couple. You have a year or two to eat it before it's all stale.
Yeah.
Go.
Go, go, go.
You could excuse that behavior so easily.
And you're like, I'll lose the weight later.
I'm hiking 25 miles away across the entire country. I think I can afford to eat a candy bar or two in the afternoon. I'm doing it.
I'd totally do that. Yeah, and I think the moment for me where Harold just kind of teetered into villain territory... Because he's been pretty protective of Franny, because they knew each other, and he kind of has the hots for her. I think they said he had a crush on her before.
Yeah.
But there's also kind of this, well, we're from the same place, so he kind of has this element of, like, I deserve to be with her.
She was the local hot girl anyway, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. But you think, oh, he might get over that. And then so Franny was, like, holding off on doing anything with Stu, because she didn't want to, like, hurt Harold's feelings or, like, make him snap or anything. And they finally decided to sleep together. And then, apparently, Harold was hiding in the bushes watching them have sex.
Yeah.
Which was, like, a really creepy detail for me. And then he went and read Fran's diary, which was not okay.
Violation number two.
And then after he did it and he put it back, he, according to Stephen King, quote, masturbated bitterly. Before he went to sleep, and I was like, oh my god! Could you be any more disgusting? Like, what the fuck about that situation has inspired you to masturbate? Doesn't make any sense. What the hell?
Sad, tragic masturbation.
Yeah, like...
It's not the most common form of it, probably.
Oh, that was weird. I was like, Stephen King, what have you done? Stop it.
It makes me wonder under what circumstance Stephen King masturbates.
I don't like it. So yeah, that was not okay. And then he kind of had some moments to redeem himself, but he never really did.
He comes right up to the precipice probably two or three times at least. Once they've settled down in their new society in Boulder, the free zone, they call it.
The free zone.
He's actually is kind of cut out of the main leadership of the group because a couple of the folks who weren't traveling with him had a creepy vibe off of him.
Yeah, rightly so.
Rightfully so, yeah. But he does tend to take up some lesser leadership roles within the community, and he pops up and he interacts with people. Part of it is intentional. He's definitely glad-handing people and trying to make himself a more popular figure, but he has good ideas and he does good work, and he keeps coming right up to the point emotionally of thinking that, well, maybe these people aren't so bad after all, and I'm just acting like a fucking teenager.
Yeah. Maybe I should just get over it. Like, maybe I could be an adult and not be pissed that Franny and Stu are together.
Yeah.
And then,
Nope.
I'm gonna kill Stu.
Yeah. I'm gonna kill the entire council and leave town.
Yeah, plant a bomb in their closet.
Yeah.
Which was rude for me because he killed Nick Andros, who was one of my favorites.
Yeah, and if he had lived through the whole book, probably would have been in the running for the protagonist title.
Yeah, pwned some noobs. Yeah.
He's deaf-mute.
Love Nick Andros.
But he's frickin' smart and resourceful.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that sucks for him is he can only talk to you by writing on a piece of paper, but Yeah, he's a smart guy.
He seems to connect with people really quickly.
Uh-huh.
Like, despite that communications handicap.
Yeah, like, well, for example, after everyone dies and he's kind of wandering around on his own, the first person he runs into is Tom Cullen, who is mentally retarded. Not, like, extremely severely, but to the point where...
Definitely, yes, just not profoundly so. He can function, like, if you say, hey, Tom, we're gonna go do this, he can definitely go do whatever you're talking about.
Right. And he was actually taking care of himself okay.
Yeah.
So that means he's at least, you know, functional. But he can't read, which
right.
makes sense. And so Nick's the first person he's the first person Nick runs into. Nick tries to write down, like, hey, what's up? I'm Nick. I can't, you know, I'm a deaf mute. Tom's like, oh, can't read.
Laws no.
Laws no, Tom Cullen can't read. And Nick's like, oh, shit. But they end up, like, getting along really well, actually.
Yeah. Nick is Tom's buddy.
Yeah.
They're BFFs in short order.
Yeah. It works pretty well.
Nick is such a good guy. Tom is also such a good guy.
Yeah.
I think that's why Nick likes him pretty much immediately.
Yeah.
Once he realizes they can sort of communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom has these moments of... normal, I guess, functioning,
yeah.
where he'll kind of zone out for a few seconds and then pop back to reality, and he'll have made some epiphany in the meantime.
Yeah, like, he's really confused why Nick won't talk to him, and Nick keeps trying to, like, you know, point at his throat,
yeah.
and he kind of has one of those moments and then goes, oh, you're a deaf mute.
Now I get it.
Yeah, it works. And I think the moment where you see Tom really doing the most, well, I guess the spy thing, I was thinking just the traveling,
right.
is when he and Nick are riding their bikes down the road and the tornado's approaching.
Yeah.
And Tom pulls Nick off his bike and runs down to a storm cellar with him and saves his life.
Yeah. Except tornado was right on top of him.
Yeah. It was like, convenient.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely, if you're riding your bike across the Midwest in the summer, you probably will see tornadoes.
Yeah, the odds are pretty good.
But the fact that one would drop right down on top of you is not...
Well, that's dramatically convenient. Yeah. It's one of the ways you can tell if you're in a story.
Yeah, exactly. I am willing to forgive that one. How do you know you're in a book? Tornadoes drop on your head. Well, I guess that happens to people.
Nah, it does happen to people.
But not if you're, like, you know, 1 in 1,000 who survived.
Right.
Okay, so other than that, we have Stu, Franny, Nick, Tom, Larry Underwood.
Yeah, he's one of the big characters because he gets prolonged sections that are devoted to following him around.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a musician.
Yep.
He's kind of a...
pseudo pop star.
Yeah, he's had a... big single hit.
Uh-huh.
And so it looks like he's going to have a moderately successful career in that world. If he doesn't fuck it up, yeah. And he's a little immature too, actually.
Yeah.
At the beginning. He's one of the characters who actually grows over the course of the story. Yeah, I think he's even maybe even later 20s, like 27 or something.
Okay.
But in the first part of his story, he's in California partying hard because his single's hit and he's had all this money. And someone who's really someone he's played with, an acquaintance more than a friend,
mm-hmm.
pulls him aside and says, so you realize that you spent all of your money and then some on this effing party. What the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Like, you can be moderately, pretty much using these words, you can be moderately successful.
Yeah, if you play your cards right.
Which is better than most of us are going to do, so
yeah.
pull your head out of your ass and function, moron.
So he basically says, why don't you get the hell out of town for a while, so you can get this drug dealer on your heels.
Right.
Because everyone's, like, just doing coke, apparently.
Yeah.
And so he goes back to New York to stay with his mom,
mm-hmm.
who I actually thought was a total badass.
Yeah, I really liked Larry's mom, actually. I think people keep telling Larry that he has this kind of hard streak in him, uh-huh. and she's one of those people, actually. But she definitely has some of that herself.
Yeah.
And really, Larry's character is about dealing with that hard streak in himself, because he knows it's there, but he doesn't see it as an asset for at least half of the book.
Yeah, he really struggles with, like, wanting to take care of people and, like, supporting them and getting them through, and then wanting to take care of himself and not worrying about that kind of shit.
Yeah. And he really becomes a better person when he realizes that it's okay to have a hard streak in him.
Yeah.
He has this concept of what a good person is, I think, is what his deal is.
Uh-huh.
And he's trying to fulfill that, and it's the message you get from kindergarten and after-school PSAs, which is, be kind to others, look out for other people before yourself, being selfish in any form is bad. And so mm-hmm. anytime he does something selfish, he feels terrible.
Yeah.
Well, in post-plague times, being selfish is actually a really smart decision.
Yeah.
And probably the best way to help the people with you to survive is to take care of yourself and to be no bullshit.
Right, well, I mean, Rita would never have lasted as long as she did.
Yeah.
Without Larry to kind of shove her in the right direction.
That's true, and he felt like he was kind of babysitting her, but he didn't really want to, but he felt like he had to,
uh-huh.
and she dies, which, frankly, was probably going to happen to her anyway.
Yeah, I mean, well, she's obviously addicted to pain pills anyway, so
yeah.
of some kind.
And had no clue how to function in a non-civilized society,
mm-hmm.
basically. She was an upper-crust sort who
yeah.
had always had things and people to do stuff for her, and so she just didn't.
But her death is really one of Larry's... It affects him throughout the entire book.
Yeah, it really does. Because she kind of... She ODs, basically,
yeah.
on his watch, and he struggles. It keeps coming back to him, like, later in the story, when he's trying to take care of people again, basically. Like,
uh-huh.
he's almost afraid to travel with companions for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He avoids people. He, like, gets the yips and can't ride his motorcycle
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah.
And really struggles.
Yeah, and that kept me interested in Larry. He stays pretty interesting, and I think one of the other things that's kind of interesting is he still has a struggle for longer than a lot of the other characters do, because he's with Lucy, but then, like, he's interested in Nadine.
Right.
And so he's again trying to make this decision of, like, what's the right thing to do, and that lasts pretty far into the book, so he actually gets to struggle with issues for a lot longer than a lot of the other characters do.
Yeah, right down to the very end, because even when Stu breaks his leg in the
yep.
in the gulch
mm-hmm.
or whatever the hell it was,
yeah,
he's in charge after that, and Stu has to talk him into going, but once he does, he doesn't look back.
Yeah, because he's like, we need to stay, take care of you, figure out what's going on, and then finally just has to come to grips with it, so.
Yep.
Yeah, I am a fan of Larry. He felt more main character-y at the beginning. He kind of fades a lot more as the book goes on.
He didn't get as much face time.
Yeah, so that's why we would argue he is not the protagonist. Also, he dies.
Yeah.
And, like, Stu is one of a lot of the main characters you're following around who doesn't die.
Stu and Tom and Franny all get to live.
Yep.
Though Franny really stops being in the story in book 3.
Yep.
It's
all about the men folk.
Yeah, it really is. We'll get into that in a few minutes. Let's touch on a couple of the other characters. We should at least hit the other committee folks, probably.
Okay.
So Glenn Bateman, the sociology professor.
Yes.
That's some
mediocre artist.
Yes. Trey mediocre. You know, that sociology professor thing sums him up fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
He talks a lot.
He does.
He's really smart. He's pretty clever and funny.
I liked him.
His dialogue is among the best in the book. He's just a very likable character. That's about what you get from him.
Yeah, and he's actually useful because people will be like, oh, what do you think is going to happen now? And he's like, well, in this situation, people would probably do this kind of thing.
Yeah, he kind of helps them form their new society, and he kind of plants little things in the meetings and such sometimes, because he has a pretty good idea of how crowds react to things. Mm-hmm. But not to the point where he's some crazy mastermind.
Yeah. So,
like, it's, he seems believable, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He's not like, oh, I'm a professor of sociology, and so I can shape every facet of this yeah. new society.
I will take over the world.
I am the manipulator.
The spider or
yeah.
whatever the crap you call it.
Yeah, he doesn't do that.
He is also important for his dog.
Kojak!
Or Big Steve or whatever his name
yeah,
was.
Yeah, this is his original name, apparently.
Kojak is like one of the only dogs left on the earth, basically.
Yeah, dogs and horses went down with people. And yeah. I'm assuming probably like pigs and chickens and things that are vulnerable to the flu.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kojak, I don't know if he plays a extremely important role in the story.
He saves Stu's life.
He does save Stu at the end. Yeah, okay, that's a good point. He's there a lot, though.
Yeah.
And there are a couple pages that are told from the dog's perspective, yeah. which is fairly amusing, actually.
It was kind of weird.
It's a little bit.
Explaining how he got across the country.
And he apparently lives to be, like, 17 years old yeah, or something ridiculous.
Yeah, which is, like, awesome. We decided he would become the father of all dogs.
Right. The Adam for future canines.
Yeah.
In the Americas, at least.
Yeah.
Ralph Brettner.
Ralph, mm-hmm.
Who's a...
Oklahoma? No,
he's another good old boy, Okie. Really. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just a very practical guy.
Yeah, and he's actually probably one of the biggest devotees to Abigail.
Yeah, definitely. He makes things work. That's what his job uh-huh. is. He's the sort of guy... Let's see, Abigail has a little section where she's thinking about kind of what he can do, like... what was the exact description she used? It was something along the lines of, if something in your tractor was broken, he's the guy who'd, like, slap a piece of tape on it and be like, well, that works.
Yeah.
We can still use it.
Yeah.
And not worry about, oh, well, we have to take this out and overhaul it and fix that, swap out all these parts. He'll just keep jury-rigging it so you can keep going.
Yeah. He puts the gum in the helicopter and,
yeah. and then it flies off.
Yeah. That's Ralph. I guess the last person on the committee is Sue Stern, but she, like, has no personality.
She exists to recruit Dana.
Yeah. So we won't worry about that. Let's talk about good versus evil, because that has to do with two of the big characters in the book.
Oh, sure. So once you get past everything going wrong, and the... people are kind of reorganizing a little bit. There are two poles that people are kind of being drawn to. There's in Boulder, there's the free zone. It's where the good guys are going. And in Las Vegas, of course.
Of course.
This is where all the sinners go. And so during everybody's post-plague trek across the country, they've been having these dreams and visions. And there's a vision of a dark man.
Mm-hmm.
Randall Flagg, as
the
it turns out.
The walking dude.
The walking dude is how he's most commonly referred to in this story, probably.
Tie into Dark Tower, for anyone's
yep.
read that.
Among other things, apparently.
Yeah.
I haven't read those. So he's the one who's gathering people in Las Vegas, and then Abigail Freemantle. Mother Abigail. A 108-year-old woman.
Yes. 108-year-old black woman.
Black woman, on top of that.
Who, she was born, like, what, 1886?
Something, 1882?
Yeah, I guess, so she's 108, which is ridiculous!
Yeah, right, even for a story set in 1990.
Yeah, I was...
It'd be way more ridiculous now, actually.
Yeah, well, that's true. That'd be insane.
108 is at least believably old.
Yeah. But she's kind of the side of good.
Yeah, she represents the forces of good. She's a devout believer.
Yeah, she basically believes God kept her around to do something.
There's definitely a Christian thread of good versus evil in this story.
Uh-huh.
Though it is left a little open to interpretation, still.
It never directly says, this is Satan, this is God. God wins.
Right.
But it's kind of... Like, Abigail's kind of a harbinger of God, and Tom right. Cullen's kind of a, like a speaker to God.
He's like a lesser prophet or something.
Yeah, and it kind of feels that.
Flag is definitely an avatar of evil.
Yes.
Though the satanic connection is not made so much as the God, the Christian God mm-hmm. connection is made.
Although there is also just kind of the general thread of themes you find in a lot of books of, like, Love Conquers All. Yeah. Because one of the things I was thinking that all the people from the Free Zone keep talking about is, like, well, our society's based on love and relationships and connections, and everything in Las Vegas is based around power through fear.
And, getting the trains running on time, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of like Nazis, actually.
A little bit.
Like, under Hitler, trains always run on time, but... You know, people don't actually really believe what you're doing. They're just too scared to say no.
Not to mention that their little secret policeman guy was... His physical description was basically identical to that of Heinrich Himmler. the little black stones they carried around. Uh-huh. Some of them had the red eye and very Sauron, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, very Lord of the Rings.
Which was mentioned a couple times and... That's actually, to me, that's a closer allegory to what this story is. It feels a little more fantasy world, great evil forces of good that are more, like, the source of goodness and the forces of good is always more diffuse.
Yeah.
Like, you always have a fellowship.
Yeah.
going after one big bad guy. You less often, I mean, you frequently will have a hero, but he always leans on his friends a lot. You rarely have one towering hero fighting against massive forces of badness that are not centered somewhere.
I was going to say, the other thing that, like, if you want to follow the Lord of the Rings example, you have, like, everything centered in Mordor or Las Vegas.
Right.
And then you have, like, you know, Gondor and Rohan and the, like, the various kingdoms of good that haven't quite, like, pulled together.
Right.
And so the good guys are kind of trying to... do that by, like, creating a government and, like, running electricity and all that stuff.
Right.
So, yeah. we'll stick with that.
we can go with that. And then the spiritual element, I think where it comes into play the most heavily, like, the visions, I guess, for one thing, though that's certainly been something that comes up in... supernatural type of storytelling, whether deities are involved or not. But definitely when Abigail goes into the wilderness and comes back and, like, just knows things, which is weird. And then she says, we can't sit here and build a society and have meetings and defeat evil that way. You guys have to... take nothing but what's on your back and
go
to Las Vegas. Basically into the desert.
Yeah.
That's happened more than once in the Bible.
And I think Glenn Bateman actually makes that observation.
Yeah.
And he also compares it to the Native American ritual of, like, going out with no food or anything until you get your vision.
Right.
which definitely reminded me of that. But speaking of the journey these guys have to go on, I'm still not entirely convinced it was necessary.
Yeah, I don't know what they actually did by going. I guess the argument would be because they went, things happened.
Yeah. maybe they couldn't have happened if they didn't go. But Trash Can Man still would have wanted to drag an atomic bomb into the middle of Vegas.
Yeah, he still burned down half their... fuel depot and airport.
Yeah.
And he still would have wanted to atone.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, you don't need to have... This warhead was huge, too, because Stu fell in that rift or whatever it was, like, hundreds of miles from Las Vegas, and he saw the explosion easily.
Yeah.
So, I'm thinking, we're talking... like, one of the really big warheads here. Like a 20 megatonner or something like that.
Yeah, and it also totally destroyed Trash Can Man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, before it even went off.
The grossest thing
ever. The radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
But like, a bomb that big, people don't exactly need to be gathered in this town square for it to wipe all of them out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if Flag had been 10 miles away, that blast probably would have taken him out.
Yeah, probably. Well, at least the fallout would have.
And Trashy was dragging it right up to his doorstep anyway.
Look what I found!
Look, Master, look what I found.
Oh, God. Shit. Yeah, the one argument I read online, because I was trying to see what other people thought about the ending, I don't know if it's a general complaint, but Ben and I were talking about how the climax happens, and it's not like huge climactic final battle. It's just like, oh, there's the climax, and then there's like 150 pages of after that don't feel extremely necessary. So I was reading online to see like what other people thought, and the argument I guess some people make is that if the four guys hadn't left Boulder and walked to Vegas, Flag would not have been distracted and would have figured out what Trash Can Man was doing before he got there. But he was already pretty distracted by the spies, by Nadine, and by everything else, so I don't know if I buy that 100%.
Yeah, I don't really see it. I think it was more like, you have to go on a holy quest, and because you went on the quest, bad forces of bad were defeated. Like, I think it's just a really vague connection, personally. I don't think the specifics... I would actually not be surprised if Stephen King didn't consider the specifics important.
Yeah. Well.
He was just like, here's the quest, here's what's going to happen, and that's how it's going to go. Well, how did the quest cause... Why is the quest necessary? Because Abigail said it was. Yeah. Have you been paying attention?
And that kind of let me down a little bit, just because, like, I thought Abigail was a badass because she's 108 and like still like chopping off the heads of chickens and stuff, and then she goes on this quest and comes back and says, go on this journey, and like, oh, my role is now fulfilled, that I've told you to do that, I'm gonna die. But then the role that she fulfilled was so vague, and then the journey was so vague, that I kind of felt like I would have liked something a little more concrete. Especially because, like, when she first met Nick, and she's like, oh, I've been dreaming of you, Nick. And she thought, like, the two of them were going to figure it out. And then he died, and I was like, I don't understand. The connections are not happening.
He died, but he did have enough spiritual badassness to hang out and guide Tom.
That's true.
After he died.
I guess you could argue that Nick saved Stu's life.
Yeah, see? Good. It was a group effort.
Yeah.
Kojak, Nick, and Tom. Even though... Kojak's a dog, and Nick was dead, and Tom's mentally retarded.
Yeah. They did it.
It's a pretty ragtag little committee you have there.
I want to read a book about that. They did a good job. I was actually pretty annoyed when Stu lived. That was kind of a cop-out, but...
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, if you're going to kill everyone else off.
Yeah.
So, we could probably talk for another hour and a half about just characters if we wanted to. For our purposes, I think we're not going to do that. So, how about some of the issues that you come across in this book? Obvious one to start with is that almost all of the characters we've spent extended time talking about have been men.
Yeah, that was a problem that I brought up to Ben, I think, before I even hit the halfway point on the book. I was like, we have Franny, and then we have Stu, Larry, Nick, Tom,
Ralph,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And you get Franny, you get Mother Abigail, who kind of almost doesn't count just because she is such like a spiritual, otherworldly figure almost.
I agree, she's almost like a magical creature.
Yeah. And then you have Nadine, who's pretty interesting and messed up, but not really a great example of, like, a good guy female character.
She's another, like, victim of prophecy, almost.
Yeah. Rita has to be taken care of and then overdoses.
Lucy and Sue have names but don't do anything.
Yeah.
Dana is a badass,
and I was extremely happy that Dana was such a badass.
The whole spy episode basically caused Flag to start losing it.
Yeah.
Because Judge Farrell, who we also really Ferris. Judge Ferris, who we also really like, but not enough to remember his name, apparently. You know, Flag knew he was coming and was going to have him killed, but he put up enough of a fight despite being over 70 years old that his head wasn't intact enough to ship back to Boulder.
Yep.
And Dana confronts Flag directly, though he also knew she was coming. And
yeah.
Does some crazy magical shit, and but basically doesn't get the information out of her. She goes...
She... Okay. She runs across the room, throws herself headfirst as hard as she can against the window, doesn't completely go through it because it's thick enough, so I think she, like, breaks through to, like, her shoulders or something. Not dead yet, but pretty fucked up. And she's panicking because she thinks Flag's going to be able to get this information out of her that Tom Cullen is the third spy. And so he goes to pull her out of the window, and she jerks her head to the side as hard as she can and impales her neck and eye with shards of glass and kills herself instantly. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, that woman is hardcore.
Like, I don't think I could do that. I think I would probably do Tom. He did it. Okay.
And then he can't even detect Tom.
Yeah.
So the three spies are basically three failures for him, and they're his first three failures.
Yep. And start driving him crazy. So, yeah, Dana gets props. Franny gets props, even though she gets kind of boring just because a lot of the other guy characters get boring, so it's not really like
right. She's
the only boring one.
She's at least getting FaceTime.
Yeah, but then I thought it was pretty weak, like, that there wasn't at least one more substantial good guy female character.
Yeah, I mean, Larry's mom was cool, but she didn't last past the first couple hundred pages.
Uh-huh. And I mean, not that I'm going to accuse Stephen King of anything, but I think it's more of a trend for male writers, if they're not, like, paying attention or being conscious of it, to write fewer female characters.
I'd say it's definitely true.
And so, I mean, depending on the genre, female authors will sometimes write more female characters, although you usually do have a significant men in those stories, but... I don't know, I feel like sometimes male authors just forget, oh, it's 50% of the population, because they're thinking more like, what do I know? I know right. How to write a guy. And then so you get...
And so they do.
You get a lack of women. And it wasn't, like, a deal-breaker for me, but it was kind of distracting. Like, it did bother me.
It could be a little frustrating from time to time. And you also made the comment that... He can't really... He seems to not be able to have women in this story without them pairing off with some dude.
Yeah. Yeah, like, every single woman that shows up falls in love with a guy.
Yeah.
Like, basically, the only thing we know about Lucy is she's madly in love with Larry Underwood. That kind of crap. So, that was pretty disappointing for me.
Yeah. And then, let's see... There was...
Talk about the racial issue.
Yeah, well, why don't you start with Abigail on that?
Okay.
That was your thing.
Yeah. there's a trope in the world. You can look it up on TV tropes. It's called the magical Negro trope. And it's this idea that when white authors put significant black characters into the story, they usually end up being this older, wiser, sage-like figure that... isn't actually, like, a real character. So, for example, some people accuse The Green Mile of that, because John Coffey is kind of this other worldly, spiritually kind of magical character. An example that you hear a lot is if you've ever seen the movie The Legend of Bagger Vance,
right. Which
pretty much everyone hates. Will Smith is, like, the caddy to the white main character, but he's kind of this weird otherworldly, like, he kind of just shows up and then kind of just disappears, and while he's there he helps the white guy win the golf tournament and then just goes away. And so it's kind of this idea of, like, the magical black person helps the white people figure out their problems, but then, like, they don't really have their own set of issues going on. And I read that Stephen King tends to do that. I don't know how true that is. Because someone, like, accused The Shawshank Redemption of that, but I would argue that Morgan Freeman's character in The Shawshank Redemption is not, does not fit the trope.
Yeah.
Because he's not
magical.
Magical at all. Mother Abigail, like, when she first appeared on the page, a couple pages in, I went, uh-oh. I think she kind of fits that trope.
I could see that. It all fits to me. They're also, I don't know if this was so much racism or just society being racist and the writing of the book mirroring that a little bit. In the early going, there are a couple of uses of racial slurs that feel really jarring. And then it pretty much goes away after that.
Yeah.
But the people saying them are mostly people who would have been born in, like, the 1930s and 40s and who think rock and roll is weird.
Yeah.
So, that's the context for at least a couple of those, too.
I mean, I guess you could look at the character palette as a whole and say, who is black besides Mother Abigail?
Right. For some reason, in my head, Nick Andros was always black. I have no idea
That's why. Awesome. Because he's a badass.
I always pictured him that way.
I would accept that.
I don't think it was ever mentioned one way or the other. But
I know that he's played by Rob Lowe in the miniseries.
So that's pretty not black.
But I can accept that. I was actually unclear as to whether or not is Randall Flagg supposed to be black?
I think he's a white dude who dresses in black.
Okay. I wasn't sure on that one. Because they call him, like, the Dark Man.
The Dark Man.
You're like, well,
I think it's spiritually dark in his case.
Yeah. Which I would say is probably some credit, because if you make, like, the embodiment of evil black and then, like, none of your other characters are black, people are probably going to be like, side-eye.
Yeah, right.
Like, what are you doing?
I do like it when authors don't go out of their way to mention someone's race. They'll give you a name and they'll just have them be who they are.
Yeah.
You can decide in your own head what they are, and people, white guys like me, probably make them white more often than not, but probably black guys who read the same book make a lot of them black in their head if it's not mentioned otherwise.
Yeah. I would say Franny's probably white because she lives in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Larry's definitely white because his mom makes a racist comment.
Right.
Stu's probably white, being from a small town in Texas.
Yep.
So
Ralph probably is too.
Yep. Tom is actually mentioned as having, like, blonde hair, so.
Yeah, he's your Norwegian.
Yeah.
Your Norwegian stock type. But, anyway. Well, Tom, as long as we're on the subject, I thought it was interesting that there were handicapped characters playing a significant role. Because Nick is not only one of the, he's a deaf mute, not only is he one of the main characters, he's actually the leader of their council when they form their council, and then Tom is there for the whole book doing important things despite being mentally retarded.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, that is definitely something I gave this book props for, is two handicapped characters who are both extremely capable and important to the story, and either one of them is just like a throwaway, like, oh, look, I have a character who's deaf kind of thing.
Right, or, you know, Tom is, he's charming and sometimes amusing, but he's not a comic relief character.
Yeah.
And he easily could have just been like, ah, look at this crazy dude.
Look at this guy who says M-O-O-N, spells shoes.
Right. Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, and Tom actually, like, you do get a little bit about him, and he does have some emotion and depth behind him, so he isn't just, like, cardboard cutout guy. So, there is something to be said for that, for sure.
We're going to hit probably another half a dozen little points of interest here and try to get out.
There's so much in this book.
There is a lot of stuff. And it's, again, it's 1,100 pages. And when I say 2-point font, I'm exaggerating. But if I said 4-point font, I probably wouldn't.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I'd sit down and be like, I have an hour to read this book. And I read fast. And I would read, like, 20, 30 pages and look up, and an hour would have passed. And I was like, what?
It's a really intimidating read.
Yeah.
So, One of the things... Okay, well, let's start with another character. The Kid.
The Kid.
A point of interest because you can't not think about him.
He's horrible.
He's horrific. He's... Well, he's a tiny man. He has the small man syndrome. Yeah. Clearly.
He drinks a lot.
He drinks, like, a case of beer and then sleeps 8 hours, wakes up the next morning, feels fantastic.
Yeah.
Drives his souped up
yeah.
muscle car 90 miles per hour down highways full of burnt out cars yeah. and debris.
And abuses people.
Yeah. Has his little verbal tics, which is something Stephen King loves to do with a character who's mentally unstable, which this guy clearly is.
Yeah.
Sodomizes Trash Can Man with a pistol. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you read that book, that sounds gross what Ben just said, but I had no idea and I was really disturbed by it, so you're actually better off knowing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So when you hit it, you're not like...
I found it really disturbing the first time I read the book, and the second time I found the book, it was still really uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's awful.
He wasn't in the 78 edition. That was mentioned in the foreword.
Oh, the kid wasn't?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I guess that makes sense, because he's not in it for very long.
He doesn't need to be.
That's true. He's basically in to get Trash Can Man, like, a certain more amount of the way through, and to prove his devotion to Flag by...
Yeah, because despite being an insane person who likes to watch things burn, Trash Can Man is somewhat sympathetic uh-huh. by a certain point.
Yeah.
And certainly having to deal with the kid
Oof.
Helped to make him so. Plus, it was a good chance to demonstrate Flag's power by yeah. bringing the wolves in at the end.
I was extremely happy that the kid died.
Yeah.
Like, when it was confirmed he was dead, because when, like, Trashy, like, ran away... And the wolves had surrounded the car. I was like, you don't know. He could still end up being alive later. And they found him dead. And I was like, thank God. The guy was so gross. Hate the kid.
And so, let's see. What else do I want to hit? The breakdown of society. Like, do you think it would happen that way?
Yeah, I mean, some of it for sure.
I actually tend to find it believable for the most part. Like, the outbreaks of violence where people are scared and
mm-hmm.
people...
trying to shut themselves off,
at
like...
At some point, just shutting themselves in.
Yeah, especially the description of, like, everyone going to their houses, drawing the shades, not answering the door. Like, mm-hmm. definitely, I would do that.
Probably,
it doesn't save you, but I could see how you might... Well, if I shut myself off, maybe I'll be okay.
I don't want to see sick people.
Yeah.
The part of it I had an issue with was more the, the military cover-up, I thought, was really over the top. In stories, military cover-ups are frequently really over the top. But the idea of closing off one small town and not letting anyone out and maybe even shooting on site, I can buy that.
Yeah.
For something this...
In a really extreme situation.
Well, something this deadly.
Yeah.
And even confining people in these disease research centers and studying them like that, I believe that.
Yep.
The part I don't buy into is when the disease was clearly across the entire country, and the military was still trying to, like, suppress communications and discussion about it, and, like...
Still claiming you need a vaccine for it.
Yeah, it was insane, and I think at some point you have to tell the people something. It'd be like if after 9/11 the government had said that didn't actually happen and tried to keep all news from getting out of New York City.
Yeah, which...
You have to come on the air. At some point, people know what's happening.
Yeah.
And you have to come on the air and say, wow, this is crazy. Here's what you, the citizen, should do. Stay in your house. Make sure you have plenty of canned food and water. And if you think you're getting the flu, then buy duct tape.
Yeah, I mean, they might give stupid advice, but right. they would give advice. They would try.
They'd do something to try to keep people from panicking, and by just denying everything and having military units visible all over the country and shooting people, and that's going to cause more panic. You're making it worse.
Yeah, and it was stuff like you were talking about, Ben, the little radio DJ guy who was talking about it.
Broadcast professionalism.
Sorry. And the government actually, like, bothered to dispatch people to go break into the building and kill him.
Right, and at this point, like, 3/4 of the country is dead or at least sick.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't in the early stages.
So that bothered me a bit.
Oh, the other moment that kind of stands out in that early part of the book, when all the shit's going down, is the kind of Price is Right murder spree thing going on.
Oh.
Where, like, this, I think it looks specifically mentioned, it was, like, a black group of soldiers who took over a radio station and had, like, a couple hundred people locked into an auditorium, and they would just call names, like, they had all their dog tags in a,
yeah,
in, like, a lottery wheel. And they were just pulling out dog tags, forcing the person to come down, and then they would shoot him in the head and force everyone to, like, applaud for it, like a TV show. And they just call the next person down. And the reason that was significant is because it actually managed to be on the air for a little while. Like, Franny, I think, watched it.
Yeah. She's like, that's a weird show. Why would they let that be on the air?
Yeah. She's like, oh, they obviously can't be killing them.
Right. That can't be real.
Yeah. But no, it was.
Okay, well, I could probably sit here and come up with another 24 things to mention, but let's really seriously get this wrapped up.
Okay.
So, strength of the writing.
It was, you know, good. Stephen King writes pretty much the same way across all his books, which isn't necessarily an insult.
Some people love it, some people hate it.
He's not, like, literary genius writer. Definitely. No. You don't read his prose. You're not, like, transported by his descriptions or anything.
The description that people who don't like him as much frequently use is they say, oh, he's not good. He's just readable. And he loves repeating that, by the way. If you've ever read anything, if you ever read his forewords afterwards or anything that he throws out into the public sphere where he's just talking about himself and his writing, he thinks it's hilarious that people use readable as an insult, because if you're an author trying to publish stuff, like, that's the best possible scenario. it's an apt description, though. Like, it reads easily. There's just a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, I mean, maybe the 120, 140, 120,000 words he cut out, maybe that was too much, but he definitely should not have put them all back in.
Yeah, you could cut probably 200 or 300 pages out of this book.
Because there were moments where I really was bored.
Yeah, the stuff in the free zone drags a lot.
Yeah, and then after the climax where the nuke goes off and there's still like 100 pages or more of Stu and Tom trying to get back, I was like, this is too much. That, like, I already know what happened. I don't need it.
Right.
So, I would say it's good, but there are definitely moments that are just incredibly long.
Why, context, relevance.
Well, what we wrote in the outline was, people love apocalyptic shit.
It's so true. People love seeing the end of the world happen or be narrowly averted.
Yeah.
Like, it is one of the genres out there.
And, you know, we've been reading tons of dystopia, and, I mean, that's just really popular.
It's a really convenient way to put people through a crucible and examine an aspect of society or of humanity that just, like, in isolation.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing about this book that we were talking about was this battle between good and evil. People are really drawn to that sort of thing, and this book definitely sets that all up, so that's pretty appealing, probably, yeah, to a wide audience.
And under questions, we have things written that we've already talked about.
Yeah.
So,
verdict.
I liked it. I liked it better the first time. I actually read it pretty rapidly the first time I read the book. I want to say it was 10 days at the most, probably under a week, honestly.
Which is fast.
Which is ridiculous, yeah. I mean, I probably did just swallow 200 pages a day the first time through it.
I liked it, but like I said, my main hang-up is that it did just get too long. I thought the beginning was really compelling with the outbreak of the flu and everything everyone was going through. Like, that part was fantastic. And then just as it went along, I was like, okay, let's speed it up a little bit.
On my reread, I will say I did read the first probably 300 or 400 pages in a couple days, and then took a couple weeks doing the rest.
Yeah, slowed down. And we all know what happened to me in reading the book.
And Gabs finished like 2 minutes before we started.
That's not true. what are we reading right now?
I'm reading Sonic Boom by Greg Easterbrook. It's a book about globalization and how the nature of the economy is changing. He tends to think it's actually going to get bigger and better because historically that's what the economy has been doing, and that even though we're in a slight downturn right now, it's actually not as bad as people think. But the main point is the form of it is definitely going to change. It's more ideas driven now than product driven, etc.
I'm reading, or just started reading, a book called Graceling by Kristen Cashmore. I'm not entirely sure what it's about yet. It's a definitely fantasy setting. The main character has has a grace, and I guess it's killing people, so she's becoming some sort of, like, assassin soldier for one side of this conflict. But like I said, I'm, like, a chapter in, so that's the most vague possible description of the book.
Fair enough. Anything we want to plug other than us?
Eh.
Not really. Not this week. All right. Well, hey, if you heard anything you loved or hated, though if it's the latter, I don't know how you got this far, or you just want to be in touch for whatever reason, then feel free to hop into the website www.novelideaspodcast.com and leave a comment.
You can also contact us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com if you want to shoot us an idea there and don't want to post it on the internet.
Don't want everyone else to be able to read it. Though we may share it if we like the idea. Or you can hit us Twitter at @NovelIdeasPod.
Yeah, well, we're going to try to get better at updating our Twitter feed. Been a little lame lately. But
yeah. And if you found us through something other than iTunes and you use iTunes, we are available on iTunes.
Yes. You just have to search for Novel Ideas, click on the podcast button, and you'll find us.
Yep. And leave a comment or a rating there if you like what you're hearing, especially.
We're still stuck at 2.
Because we'll take some more of those. And I guess
next week.
Yeah. Next week we will be doing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, a book that is probably about 10% the length of The Stand.
Yeah, I think Hitchhikers is like 50,000 to 60,000 words.
It's on the short end.
So we're like doing the most opposite length possible, basically.
Right. And if for some reason you don't know this book, holy crap, go out and read that book. It is one of the funniest things ever written in any genre.
It takes like, it'll take you a day or two.
Yeah.
To read it.
If it takes you 2 days, it'll be because you're busy.
And it's basically the standard of comedy science fiction. Like,
yeah, to the point that, we'll talk about this some next week a little bit too, but even to the point that some authors have said that its influence has been slightly damaging to people who want to write comedy science fiction today.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go read it if you haven't read it, because it's hilarious.
Definitely.
And
read The Stand if you are a glutton for punishment.
If you want context for the 1,000 things we talked about and the 10,000 we didn't get to. This could have been a 3-parter if we wanted to.
Yeah, oh god.
We chose not to do that to you. And ourselves. So, anyway, I think that's all for this week. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.